I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne, host of Bullseye, inviting you to a live taping of my show with my pal, actor, and comedian Paul Scheer. It's June 13th at the Crawford. Get your tickets now at laist.com/events.
You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us. Hope your week is starting off well. We'll turn our attention now to organized labor and efforts to unionize e-commerce employees. But it didn't go as intended for an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, where the union was dealt a significant loss. And so the question is, what comes next? Because that negative for union organizing comes at the same time that the Biden administration and the Democratic majority in the House of Representatives is looking to support ways making it easier to organize private sector employees. And of course, at the same time, where we have seen the significant growth in organizing is in public employee sectors, where teachers and law enforcement and firefighters and office workers, many of them are unionized and have been for some time. And that's really where the growth has been. Joining us to talk about where we stand with unionization in the United States from the New York Times, technology reporter Karen Weiss. Karen, thank you for being with us. Let's take a look more closely at the effort to organize, to unionize this Amazon warehouse. What happened?
Yeah, this is kind of a pretty quick organizing effort for trying to take on Amazon. But basically last summer, some workers at this warehouse outside of Birmingham, Alabama, contacted a union, the Retail Workers Union, and they launched a campaign kind of late summer, early fall, and there was an election that ran then kind of most of February and March, and we got the results end of last week. And the workers pretty strongly voted down the unionization effort. It was about a 70-30 split. It was a pretty big margin.
Yeah, and what in the interviews with employees that have followed, what have they said, those who voted against it, as the reasons why?
Yeah, there's a mix, I would say. Some is that, you know, people were happy with the job. It pays $15 an hour, which is higher than the minimum in Alabama. You know, they have good health insurance at Amazon. There are things like that that people find kind of fulfilling and that works. The other thing you heard a lot of is workers just saying they didn't need the union to make the changes they want. So even Amazon organized a press conference with some workers who opposed the union afterwards. And they were saying, you know, we want better training. We want better career mobility. And in the next 100 days, management is going to take all these lessons from us and really listen to us. So it's basically, it was not just a referendum on work at Amazon, but I would say it was also, does the union help, do people see help with unionization?
We're talking with New York Times technology reporter Karen Weiss. Karen, are there other efforts with e-commerce companies to unionize them? Or does this seem like because of this setback, maybe the unions are going to take a step back and reexamine their strategies?
Say that again?
Does it appear in the wake of this that unions are going to reexamine their strategies for organizing, or are there already efforts underway to try and organize other e-commerce locations?
Yeah, there have been efforts here and there around the country, and there was a lot of momentum going into this. That said, it was a big campaign. It was very high profile, and it's a high profile loss. So I think you will see kind of a rethink going on. And one of the questions is, is this, you know, under labor law as it is, you have to organize location by location by location, and it's a very expensive and exhausting effort. And so one thing you hear from labor is, should we focus more on legislation or policy rather than battles? after almost a decade of trying at Walmart, unions got nowhere. So it was a very kind of time and resource intensive effort that didn't really lead to that much at Walmart. So there's a question of, do they want to go through that Amazon, or should they take a different approach?
And Karen, before I let you go, what were the things that Amazon did to try and defend itself against unionization?
Yes, yeah, so they had mandatory sessions for employees that they had to attend. They had text messages. They were involved with setting up a mailbox on site, which was kind of a contested thing for people to return their ballots. And they just had a pretty strong campaign internally, you know, posters, signs in the bathrooms, emails, all the kind of messaging that an employer can do, because they have a lot of power of what they can say inside their building. And then the unions are not allowed or not guaranteed access to workers on the work site. So the Amazon kind of used the advantage it had, for sure. And this message was, you got a good job and you can do without dues. We can make change internally.
So for the Amazon employees, they were compensated for going to the employer mandatory meetings, obviously. And if they're going to go off site for organizing meetings, those will not be compensated.
Yes. Yeah. It's on the clock if you're doing the internal ones. And the other ones, it was hard to reach people to some extent. They focused a lot. The union focused a lot on just the stoplight outside the building and getting people in between shift changes. And some of that was a COVID strategy of not going to people's homes like you might normally, although it wasn't effective in the end. So there are disadvantages. You have to kind of find people where they're at, as opposed to having them there on the clock. Can't say, no, I don't want to go to that meeting.
Yeah. And Karen, back to the reluctance of the employees to unionize there. You mentioned the fact that they felt like, they were getting comparatively decent wages and that the company is going to be meeting with them on other changes there. Was the dues also a turnoff? I mean, was it, because that was one of the things I was looking at, is that there might have been some people who thought that the economic benefit that they would get in exchange for the dues paid, that it wouldn't work out in their favor.
Yeah, one of the workers talked about how the consultants that Amazon had that did these presentations showed a contract that the same union had at a nearby poultry plant, and that they found that the increase in pay that they got as a result of this contract wasn't that much from this worker's perspective. And so why would they spend all this money on dues and not even get that much more in pay? So that was definitely the strongest messaging, and I have no doubt that is kind of time-tested messaging that has worked before. This is, Amazon has had a large, preference against union for years now. They've hired kind of very experienced lawyers and consultants. They know what works.
All right. Thank you so much. Good to have you with us, Karen Weiss of the New York Times. We appreciate it. Have a good rest of your day.
Thanks. You too.
Thank you. Karen Weiss, technology reporter for the New York Times, who's been covering Amazon. Also with us from Rutgers State University of New Jersey, Associate Professor of Labor Studies and Employment Relations, Rebecca Given. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what, in your view, does organized labor take from this loss outside Birmingham going forward, trying to organize e-commerce workers?
I think organized labor can take from this confirmation of some things that they already knew, which is that the current environment shaped by labor law and the lack of teeth in current labor law is really, really tipped against workers. And this has kind of put a national spotlight on that, on just how difficult it is. It is the law of the land to encourage collective bargaining, and it has been since the 1930s, but that requires access to unionizing. And right now, workers in the private sector barely have meaningful access to unionizing. So workers who want a union can try a number of different strategies from here on out. There's pushing for labor law reform, which is certainly on the agenda right now. And there's also organizing in different ways. For example, not seeking formal collective bargaining rights, but putting their demands forward in more short-term ways, walkouts, other actions where they might not get collective bargaining, but they might win on some particular issues that are important to them.
If there were some changes in the laws that would allow unions more access to employees at a place like this warehouse. What might be some of the things that they would do that would perhaps convince employees who were skeptical about this that it was in their economic interest?
I think having a frank conversation with workers about why employers are so opposed to organizing could be really, really illuminating. I think a lot of workers are fearful because that fear is instilled in them by the employers who basically wage a campaign of uncertainty and anxiety, making them think that voting to unionize might not lead to improvements on the job. So I think demonstrating how they're impacted currently by having no voice on the job, that those really taxing shift schedules and that the physically demanding, grueling nature of these jobs, the fact that nobody can view this as a long-term job because it's so hard on the body, all of those things are things that can be addressed through a strong collective bargaining agreement, but you can't explain that or give examples to workers if you don't have the opportunity to talk with them.
We're talking with Rutgers University Professor Rebecca Given, and I welcome your calls, your thoughts about what we saw last week with this rejection of unionizing at an Amazon warehouse in Bessemer, Alabama, what that means for efforts to unionize e-commerce companies. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, KPECC.org. Just a couple months ago, the Democratic Majority House of Representatives passed a bill that would make it easier for employees to form unions. What does that legislation specifically do, Professor Given?
The PRO Act, as passed by the House and with an uncertain fate in the Senate, basically does a few different things. One is it provides enforcement and real teeth to some of the laws that are some of the regulations that are currently on the books that have been essentially rendered irrelevant because employers can violate the law with no real deterrent. So adding teeth to some of the provisions that exist about not, for example, firing workers for trying to organize a union. And there are a number of provisions that would, for example, give unions equal access to employees during an organizing drive, not allow these captive audience meetings where workers are mandated on the clock to sit and listen to the anti-union sort of campaigning of the employers. And it goes at the shortcomings and the imbalance in the law from a number of different directions to try to reset things and return to that original mission to promote collective bargaining.
And what would the effect be on some states' right to work laws, which which make it more difficult to unionize companies?
Yeah, right to work laws, are also known as open shop laws, essentially say that states can pass laws that mandate that unions represent everybody in a relevant workplace or collective bargaining unit, but can't collect any of the cost of representing those workers. And it's designed to basically financially drain unions of resources and make them have to do a lot of representation and negotiation work while starving them of the money that it costs to do that work. And the PRO Act, as it currently stands, would actually outlaw those provisions, which would be a significant change in those right-to-work states that are mostly in the South.
We're talking with Rutgers University Professor Rebecca Given. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us is professor at UC Santa Barbara, historian Nelson Lichtenstein. He directs the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. Professor, it's good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
So your thoughts about where we are in this historic continuum when it comes to unions, because we sort of have the union feast when it comes to public sector employees, but it looks like, you know, the trend is pretty clear in the private sector. It's much tougher times for them.
Right. It certainly is. And your previous speakers made that very clear. Let me just say that I think there was a very, very bright silver lining to this defeat. A defeat is a defeat. There's no doubt about it. But I do want to make say there was some bright silver linings here. So first, the union, when it began organizing very, very quickly, or rather the workers inside the Amazon distribution center approached the union. And very quickly after the distribution center was set up, which is quite unusual, and initially they had a very healthy, maybe even a majority of the workers signing cards and whatnot. And then what Amazon did was they went on a hiring spree to boost the numbers so that it would reduce the committed unionists. But nevertheless, while there was a 2-to-1 official vote against the union, it was actually much closer than that, because about 500 votes were challenged by Amazon, and these were almost certainly pro-union votes, and they were challenged. So there was somewhat closer than that. But the main thing, and here I speak as a historian of Walmart. I wrote a book about Walmart 10 years ago, and there were lots of efforts to organize Walmart, and they failed. But when that happened, yes, there were a few newspaper articles and presentations on TV about how Walmart was a difficult place to work and the wages were low and whatnot. But nothing compared to what we saw in the last 2 or 3 months. And I think the news coverage became more than just news coverage. It indicated a real shift in sentiment. Certainly among the chattering classes. In a way that wasn't true 10 or 20 years ago when it came to other egregious employers. So I think that and the very fact that President Biden made this 2-minute video in late February was quite remarkable, and that will be used by trade unionists in every organizing campaign for the next 4 years, for sure.
We'll continue our conversation with UC Santa Barbara historian Nelson Lichtenstein. He's a labor historian, also with us from Rutgers University in New York, associate professor of labor studies and employment relations. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Your thoughts about what unions do in the wake of the defeat they suffered at Amazon's Bessemer, Alabama warehouse last week. We'll be back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk on KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. We're talking about the future of labor unions in the wake of the loss that the union took in attempting to organize the employees of an Amazon warehouse facility in Bessemer, Alabama. That defeat last week, as unions have tried to find ways of organizing employees within e-commerce companies, because they've been seeing so much loss of unionized jobs in the private sector as public sector unionization has increased. Rebecca Given, professor at Rutgers in New Jersey. What about some of the other emerging fields in employment? For example, tech. Is that something where labor unions have set their sights on organizing there?
Yeah, I mean, we can think about what workers want and what workers in tech want. And we're seeing the trajectory now from especially the white collar tech workers who perhaps for some time felt this sense of gratitude for some of their conditions of work, but are now starting to sort of fight back and think about organizing, whether in unions or through mass walkouts or other things, to say, you know what, we're not actually okay with, for example, sexual harassment, gender pay gaps. We're not okay with not having a voice at work, the workers in the video game industry who get subject to this intense crunch time. So we're seeing some action, and it's taking different forms. So sometimes it's simply speaking out, sometimes it's more organized and collective, sometimes there are efforts to unionize, and workers are really starting to say, you know what, we should have a voice on the job. We don't necessarily have to just take everything as determined by our bosses.
But is much of this going to come down to, the same issue as apparently the Amazon employees were dealing with? Will I end up paying more in union dues than I'm really going to get in additional compensation this way?
when workers decide to unionize, it's never a simple value transaction. So while they might think about that, we know from what's known as the union wage premium, or how much more unionized workers make than non-unionized workers, it does turn out to be far more than what they're paying in dues. But workers choose to unionize because they want to work collectively and reclaim some power on the job. They don't do it because it's a simple, pros and cons or a accounting transaction. They do it because they want to work collectively with their workers. They want a voice. They want to be able to speak up without fear of retaliation. They want due process. They don't want to be able to be fired for no reason at all, which most workers in America deal with. They want something more. They're not looking at it as just, what will the cost of dues be, and is that worth it? There's a lot more that's at stake when workers decide to organize.
So if those are things that workers want, then why do we see such low penetration rates of unions in the private sector?
We see the result of really a decades-long campaign by employers to drive unions out and to make sure that it's harder and harder for workers to organize. We know from polling data that many more workers would like to have a union. They just don't feel that they have access, and there's a huge gap between wanting a union and successfully organizing under current law. So the current level of unionization really doesn't reflect how many workers would like to be in a union and be represented together in a union.
So how does it work more easily for unions in the public sector?
It really depends on the law, but in many states like California, much of the Northeast, the laws make it more straightforward to organize, and they don't allow the employers, whether we're talking school districts, cities and counties, to oppose unionization in the same way. And that means that workers who want to be in a union have an easier time making that happen.
We're talking with Rutgers University Professor Rebecca Given. Also with us, Nelson Lichtenstein, who's UC Santa Barbara Professor of History. He directs the Center for the Study of Work, Labor, and Democracy. Professor, just real briefly, what do you think the prospects are for the Biden administration, coupled with a Democratic majority in the House, with a lot of funding that comes from labor unions into Democratic candidates? So there's definitely a vested fiscal interest. What are their prospects for making these policy changes that would aid unionization?
Well, normally I would say that they're rather poor. If this was a guide, that is, every time a Democratic president has come into power with the Democratic Congress, there's been a labor law reform bill that has been put forward, and in every case, it's been defeated either through the filibuster or just the divisions within the Democratic Party, and from Carter to Clinton to Obama. With Biden, it's just barely possible that we could have a break with that dismal tradition in terms of legislation, because I think there is a growing realization within among the Democrats and even centrist Democrats that the trade union movement has always been a bulwark of the Democratic Party, not because they give money. That's not the reason. What they do is they're one of the few institutions on the left, or the center left, that can mobilize people in an interracial fashion. And in a permanent institutional fat way, they're the Democrats equivalent of the evangelical mega churches.
All right, I appreciate it, Professor. We need to conclude. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate your being with us for another edition of Air Talk on KPCC. Coming right up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, the interview with writer, director, and actor Emerald Fennell, Promising Young Woman, the movie she wrote and directed, which is multi-Oscar nominated.
Support for LAist comes from Apple TV Plus, presenting Monarch, Legacy of Monsters, starring Kurt Russell, Wyatt Russell, Anna Sawai, and Godzilla. Father and son acting duo Kurt Russell and Wyatt Russell play older and younger versions of Lee Shaw, the founder of Monarch, a secretive organization connected to Godzilla. As actors and team players, Kurt and Wyatt have a lot in common.
We've had a similar life. His game was hockey, mine was baseball. One point in our lives, it was how we were going to make our living. To apply that to our business, I don't know how to look at life other than as a win-lose ball game. I think we're the type of people that like we want to be impact players. And you want to help your club win every time you go out there, whether that club's a movie set, a story you're telling, on the ice, on the baseball field.
I think we realize that we are much more alike than we are different.
Here's executive producer Chris Black.
I think it should be about this family. I think it should be about secrets. It should be about a pair of siblings discovering each other and discovering that their father could not be trusted and was not the man he said he was. That's what brings them together and sends them on a quest, if you will, to find out the truth about the family and their father. And it's that journey that takes you into the world of the monsters.
For Kurt and Wyatt Russell, being so close helped them sort out how to both play the same character.
We work together quite a bit. We work together well.
What's been your most favorite part of the show?
When I was working with you on trying to figure Lee Shaw out, yeah. You know, and then taking it to the guys and saying, what do you think? Who is this guy? Where is he going to go? Where did he come from? And doing that with you, I've actually never done that really with another actor, but I've never played
the same role.
So that was fun.
TV Line says Monarch, Legacy of Monsters is incredible. And Empire roars that it's epic. More on Monarch, Legacy of Monsters at fyc.appletvplus.com.